Geekscape.com. The Truth About Lynching and the Negro of the South. Chapter 4, The Criminality of the Negro. The present criminal status of the Negro, and his criminal record since the Civil War as well, should cause every member of the race in America to hang his head in shame. Yet, may it not be that, after all, the Negro is, to a large extent, an irresponsible creature of circumstances, and that his crimes are upon the heads of those who unwisely placed him in a position that he was unable to occupy, except with injury to all concerned. Scholars hold that the average citizen of the ancient Athenian democracy, the greatest of ancient democracies, was as intelligent as the average member of the British Parliament or of the American Congress. The Negro, however, with all his barbarism and ignorance, totally unrelated to the white man in origin, character, and race, directly after his emancipation, was made a full-fledged citizen in the greatest of modern democracies. The fact is appalling. Stupidity unsurpassed, unless by the pacifist visionaries of the present day, who seek to usher in the millennium by proclamation, peace treaties, world federations, or leagues to enforce peace. Human nature cannot be changed overnight by edict. When the sun fails to rise, wars will cease. It is to be hoped that enough sanity yet remains in the American people to save them from such nonsensical vagaries of sentimental dreamers. But the Negro, son of a wild and tropical race, content for thousands of years to roam the jungles of Africa, supplied by bountiful nature with all his heart's desire, failing thus to develop any controlling trait of character or mental stamina, and although civilizations rose and fell beside him, it meant nothing to him. And even now, in the midst of American civilization, he is moved to action mainly by the gusts of primitive emotion and passion. This is the creature that was expected to take an equal share in the government of the most enlightened and progressive people that the world has ever known. Who sows to the wind shall reap the whirlwind. So today, all other domestic problems or questions pale before what shall be done about the Negro. The mob acts upon it. Conventions or learned sociologists discuss it. Every superficial thinker has a solution of the problem ready-made, but never in good working order. The Negro is such a problem in our society, mainly, no doubt, because he represents the chief criminal element. How criminal? Let statistics, by way of comparison, declare. In the northern and western states in 1910, one white person was in a penal institution for every 982 of the white population, and one Negro for every 123 of the Negro population. While in the south, the ratio was 1 to every 2014 for the white, and one Negro to every 308 of the Negro population. Thus, in the North, Negroes had 8 times their proportion in prison, and in the South, 6.5 times. That Negro crime is on the increase is evidenced by the fact that in 1890, the Negroes had hardly 6 times their proportion in prison in the North, and hardly 5 times their share in the South. In this connection, statistical tables should be helpful and interesting as well. Table 1 gives a comparative showing of whites and Negroes in some state penitentiaries, instead of giving the numbers of prisoners on hand at a certain time. Some prison reports give the number received and discharged during a certain period of time, while a few give both. And in Table 2 is given the number of prisoners received by the penitentiaries of a few states during a specified time. For the southern states considered, Table 1 shows that the number of Negro prisoners around 1910 varied, according to the state, from 5-plus times their proportion in Louisiana to 11 times in Georgia, while in the north their number varied from 8 times in Connecticut to 17-minus times in Kansas. Thus showing that the Negro is everywhere, many times more criminal than the white man, and that his criminality is more pronounced in the North than in the South. That he is discriminated against by the court and otherwise is sometimes given as a reason for the great criminal showing of the Negro, that for the same kind of crime, the Negro gets a much longer sentence than a white man. This is hardly to be held as against the North, and that it is true to any appreciable extent in the South is doubtful, but hard to determine absolutely. As Table 1 gives the number of prisoners on hand at a certain time, and Table 2 the number committed to prison during a period of time, other things being equal, it is clear that if the Negro is discriminated against through the length of sentence imposed on him by the court, it should be shown by a smaller number being sent to prison in proportion to the respective population of the two races in any state that is to be found on hand at a certain time. For instance, at the Maryland and the Texan penitentiaries, according to the above tables referenced, in 1910 the numbers of Negroes on hand were, respectively, 8 minus times and 8 plus times their proportion, while those committed for the same year were 7 plus and 17 respectively. This would seem to indicate that in neither Maryland nor Texas was there but little, if any, discrimination against the Negro. But a comparison of the statistics for Kansas and Louisiana seems to show that the Negro is discriminated against in these states. However, upon further investigation, it is found that 91 Negroes were sent to the Louisiana Penitentiary in 1911 for murder and manslaughter, and 32 for shooting with intent to kill, as against 30 white men during the same year for these crimes. Again, in the Arkansas Penitentiary, in November 1912, there were 213 white and 643 Negro prisoners. Of the whites, but 50 had committed homicide, while 218 of the Negro prisoners were guilty of this crime. Moreover, one might naturally expect that the whites, on account of a greater influence, would be much more likely to secure pardons. It is doubtful if the whites are thus favoured to any large extent. Between November 1, 1910, and October 31, 1912, Arkansas granted pardons to 121 whites and 86 Negroes. While during the year ending November 30th, 1911, Kentucky pardoned 9 white men and 18 Negroes. If statistics were available from all the states, it might be rather conclusively demonstrated that the Negro is discriminated against but little by the courts. In this connection, it may be well also to note the fact that in Ohio, 14 minus times as many as their proportion were sent to the penitentiary, in West Virginia 15 times, and in North Dakota 43 times their proportion. Table 3 shows that for the cities given, One white person, 221+, of the white population, was arrested during 1910 or thereabouts, but 1 to 8- of the Negro. In the cities of the North, 1 to 23 whites were arrested, and 1 to 6 Negroes in the South, excluding Wilmington, Delaware, and Washington. 1 to 20 whites and 1 to 8 for the Negroes. In Detroit, 1 for every 2+ Negroes were arrested. In this connection, it would seem that a comparison of the jail population of a northern and a southern state might be of interest. For this purpose, Alabama and Connecticut were selected. In 1910, Alabama had a white population of 1,228,832 and 908,282 Negroes, while Connecticut had 1,098,897 whites and 15,174 Negroes. In both Alabama and Connecticut, the ratio of whites and Negroes sent to jail during the fiscal year ending September the 30th, 1914, was about the same, 1 white to 4 Negroes. However, in Alabama, 1 white person to 216 of the white population, as against 1 to 54 of the Negro, while in Connecticut, 1 white person to 100 and 1 Negro to 20 was put in jail. Again, the 4 counties of Connecticut, embracing the large cities of the state and having nearly all the Negro population, sent to jail 1 white to 92 of the white population and 1 Negro to 24 of the Negro, or nearly 4 times their proportion. But in the other 4 counties, with an aggregate of 187,058 whites and 1,661 Negroes, the ratio was 1 to 174 for the whites and 1 to 64 for the Negroes, or hardly 3 times as many. Now, taking the 3 counties of Alabama, in which the cities of Montgomery, Mobile, and Birmingham are located, with an aggregate population of 207,295 whites and 182,211 Negroes, 1 white person to 90 was sent to jail, and 1 Negro to 21, or nearly 4.5 times as many. Moreover, 22 counties with no towns of more than 1,000 population each, and having a total population of 293,187 whites and 274,533 Negroes, 1 white to 523 was sent to jail, and 1 Negro to 141, or nearly 4 Negroes to 1 white. In studying the jail statistics of Alabama, whether cities or counties, it soon becomes evident that the criminality of the Negro increases as his proportion to the whole population decreases. In other words, the fewer the Negroes in a given population, the more criminal they appear. An examination of tables 1, 2, and 3 will show that this is not only true of Alabama, but true, with scarcely an exception, both North and South. Negro crime seemingly increases in the cities and in the North and the West. So does the crime of the white man increase, although not to the same extent. In general, the denser the population, the more likely is friction to occur, or collisions among its units. But this is not an adequate explanation for the increase of Negro crime, nor can it be accounted for, except in small part, by attributing it to the more complex social environment of the cities and of the North. However, it is not to be doubted that the unstable character of the Negro is easily influenced by the temptations incident to city life. More important, no doubt, is the assumption that where Negroes are few, in comparison with the whites, they are more tempted to commit acts of thievery, robbery, and burglary. Again, in the cities, officers of the law are on the watch, consequently more apt to detect and catch a criminal. Also, where the Negroes are few, they are likely to be held more strictly to the white man's standard of conduct. However, in some parts of the South, a white man sometimes may be arrested, when for the same act, a Negro would hardly be bothered. The idea seems to obtain that for certain things, allowance must be made for the ignorance of the Negro, but no excuse is made for the white man. Again, a great deal of the friction between the two races in the South is caused by the resistance of Negro criminals to officers of the law. Not only so, but relatives, friends, and other Negroes as well often attempt to shield the Negro criminal in order that he may escape detection and arrest. This is not exceptional, but rather of frequent occurrence. It is one of the ways in which the black man shows himself to be an enemy of law and order. He does not seem to realize the attitude in which he places his race in acting thus. Now, where the Negroes form a large part, or the greater part of the population, it is much easier for him to aid Negro criminals, and it is often effectively done. But where there are but few Negroes in the population, it is to that extent more difficult for the Negro criminal to escape detection and arrest. These seem to be the main reasons why Negroes appear more criminal where there are but few in the population. In addition to statistics, a few newspaper clippings may aid one more fully to appreciate Negro criminality. It is hardly probable that anywhere in the United States has the Negro, on the whole, had better advantages than in Maryland, Virginia, and Delaware. Especially is this true of the eastern shore of Maryland. For this reason, the following are the more significant. John E. Good, a Negro, blew off the top of his head at Bedford City this morning in preference to appearing as a witness against Thomas W. Preston, the Negro murderer of M.D. Custy, a saloon keeper. Goody was present when the murder was committed. A Negro family named Davis, relatives of Preston, are said to have threatened Goody's life if he testified. A Negro in Chestertown, M.D., being tried on three charges of arson, attacks the officers of the court. Pointing to the Negro state's attorney, Vickers intimated that he had set fire to the beautiful buildings on the grounds of the Washington College near Chesterton. Suddenly, the Negro made a leap for the state's attorney, but was stopped by Deputy Sheriff Brown. The enraged Negro turned and struck the Deputy Sheriff a stunning blow under the chin. It required seven men to quiet the Negro. John Carter, the Negro who shot policeman Elizabeth Faber and patrolman George W. Pop on October the 17th on the Edmondson Avenue Bridge when they attempted to arrest him, died in the city jail at 3:10 yesterday morning. The final decision in the Brownsville incident is closed, finally, and the verdict will give entire satisfaction to everybody, except Honorable Joseph Foraker of Ohio, the Negro soldiers who shot up the Texas town, and their comrades who concealed the guilt of the bloodthirsty marauders. Negro soldiers of the 24th United States Infantry had planned a riot of bloodshed among the white residents of Houston, Texas, August the 23rd, 2 days before the deadly attack, which cost the lives of 15 Houston citizens last month, according to the report of the Civilian Board of Inquiry, which reported to the Houston City Council tonight. The committee says that the undisputed and convincing testimony of witnesses proves that the Negro soldiers went forth to slay the white population indiscriminately, that no Negro was hurt or molested by them, not one Negro house was fired into, and that the Negroes were warned beforehand to stay off the streets. The police of the Northwestern District are looking for about 25 Negroes who late Saturday night attempted to break down the front door of the boarding house conducted by Miss Mary Ashteen at 906 McCulloch Street. Centerville, January the 7th. The Reverend J.D. Jackson, colored, pastor of Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church, was arrested and placed in jail here today, charged with housebreaking and burglary. Middletown, Delaware. The Reverend Aaron Gibbs, a Negro preacher, is being held in $500 bail for court for alleged theft of 280 pounds of meat from the farm of Daniel Ford near this place. The meat was recovered at the home of Gibbs by a chief of police, Lee Cochran. Another Negro, Arthur Brewington, wanted for theft of meat and chickens, held the whole Smyrna police force at bay for 2 hours until his ammunition gave out. He then retreated, escaping from the force into a deep swamp 5 miles away. Seaford, Delaware, July the 3rd. Negroes who live in and around Bridgeville attempted to take the town last night. About 10 o'clock at night, the Negroes began firing among themselves, and Bridgeville, being without police protection, was at the mercy of their revolvers, which were being fired in rapid succession. The town seemed to be alive with brawling blacks, and several fights were started in different parts of the town. At the railroad station, a large crowd collected and fired shots in every direction. At a colored church, another crowd got together, firing desperately among themselves. The citizens, being utterly helpless, stayed in their houses behind locked doors. Negroes at picnics and on excursions. Federalsburg, August the 14th. John Henry Lake, a Hurlock Negro, was killed, and Frank Dickerson wounded, perhaps fatally, at a celebration by Negroes last night. Gettysburg, September the 11th. Clara Brown of Baltimore, colored, was shot in a brawl here in the course of an excursion and a picnic. Her condition is critical. 3 other persons were also injured. Their picnickers had a gay frolic. It is charged that 50 of them attacked a policeman, and one of them robbed Robert King of Hunterstown of $35. There were about 7,240 excursionists. Gettysburg has made a protest. Roanoke, March the 29th. Drunken Negroes took charge of an excursion train between this city and Winston-Salem last night, and as a consequence, Sidney Wood of Winston-Salem is dead at Martinsville, and 20 other Negroes are more or less wounded. Knives, razors, and pistols played prominent parts in the melee. The train was stopped several times by Negroes pulling the bell cord, and the train was cut in two several times, leaving a number of coaches behind with a second section following. The 3 coaches which were cut off were filled with white people. When the train reached Bassett's in Henry County, every Negro in 2 coaches was apparently in a fight. The screams of the terror-stricken women added to the excitement. Negroes at camp meeting. Smyrna, August the 9th. As has been the case yearly for 12 years, there was a fatal shooting affray at the Negro camp meeting at Friendship last night. Howard Hollis, a Negro of Clayton, Delaware, was shot in both legs during the fight. It is not known who shot Hollis, as bullets were flying thick and fast during the melee. Federalsburg, September the 6th. Officers are securing Lower Caroline County today for four Negroes who last night shot up a Negro camp meeting at Mount Hope near this town. Deputy Sheriff Bruce C. Dean, yesterday afternoon, shot and killed a Negro named Smith at what is known as Henry's Crossroads camp meeting. There has always been more or less disorder. In fact, it is generally known that fights, cutting a phrase, and a general disregard for the law exists. The Negro who was killed shot at the deputy sheriff when he tried to arrest him. Salisbury, August the 23rd. A riot occurred last night at the Negro camp meeting on the west side of the county, and Asprey Waters, 19 years old, was killed, and Clinton Goslas was shot through his jawbone and his chin carried away by a bullet. Just at the height of the services, one of the local preachers was raising his hands in prayer. A coloured woman slipped into the kneeling crowd and pulled a pistol from her dress folds and fired a bullet into his heart. Waters pitched forward and died instantly. Immediately after, Sally Milburn whipped a pistol from her pocket and blazed away at Clinton Goslas, the bullet entering his jaw. Goslas is in a very serious condition, with little hope of his recovery. Both these accounts were in the same issue of the Cambridge Record, but the camps were in adjoining counties. Indeed, Negro camp meetings and bush meetings had become so numerous, occupied such a large part of the Negroes' time during summer, caused so much lawlessness among them, and consequently so much expense to the whites, that the Maryland legislature in 1916 passed a law evidently directed against them, which in part is as follows. It shall be unlawful for any person, persons, association, or organization of any kind whatever to hold any camp meeting or bush meeting within the limits of Talbot, Caroline, Dorchester, Somerset, Kent, and Worcester counties without first making application in writing at least 15 days prior to the date of such camp meeting or bush meeting therein. That such application for a permit, as aforesaid, shall be accompanied by a petition in writing, signed by at least 25 tax payers, each of whom shall reside within 3 miles of the place where such camp meeting is to be held, and each petition shall have annexed thereto as a part thereof an affidavit to the effect that each of the said petitioners are bona fide taxpayers and of their residence within 3 miles of said place of such proposed meeting. And whenever the county commissioners of any of the respective counties shall have any reasonable grounds that any lawlessness or disorder will occur at said camp meeting or bush meeting, they shall refuse to grant such permit, and if, after issuing any permit to hold any camp meeting or bush meeting, there shall be lawlessness or disorder reported to said county commissioners, it shall be the duty of said officials to investigate, or have investigated by the sheriff or other officer of said county, the matter, and upon proof of said lawlessness or disorder, they shall forthwith revoke such permit, and it shall be the duty of the sheriff or other office of the respective counties to enforce the provisions of this act. In about the same spirit, and for the same purpose, the reduction of Negro crime, a few years ago, the city of Mobile, Alabama, passed an ordinance, an account of which is taken from a Baltimore periodical. The police department of Mobile, Alabama, has established a curfew law for Negroes. Commencing on the night of July the 21st, the law provides that all Negroes must be in bed at their homes by 10 o'clock or be subject to arrest. Any caught wandering at large after that hour will be locked up. This action is taken because there is said to be an epidemic of hold-ups perpetrated by the Negroes, if such a law was enforced in Baltimore, it would decrease the Alifites 95%. In connection with Negro criminality, it seems pertinent to say something of Negro immorality. Two of the Negro's most prominent characteristics are the utter lack of chastity and complete ignorance of veracity. The Negro's sexual laxity, considered so immoral or even criminal in the white man's civilization, may have been all but a virtue in the habitat of his origin. There, nature developed in him intense sexual passions to offset his high death rate. Then, too, the economic influences which fostered a family life among other peoples were mostly lacking in tropical Africa, as nature provided abundantly without effort on the part of man. Although the regulations adopted by masters for the control of the Negroes during slavery times may have served as a check upon their natural sexual propensities, however, since emancipation, they have been under no such restraint, and as a consequence, they have possibly almost reverted to what must have been their primitive promiscuity. Huffman says that in 1894, more than one quarter of the coloured births in the city of Washington were illegitimate. Many prominent Negroes admit that above 90% of both sexes are unchaste. A Negro may be a pillar in the church, and at the same time, the father of a dozen illegitimate children by as many mothers. Another Negro failing is lying. One can believe neither layman nor minister, neither criminal nor saint among them. One may occasionally find a truthful Negro, just as he may find a virtuous or an honest one. Undoubtedly, both honest and truthful was the Negro, an elder in the church, who refused to partake of the Lord's Supper, because, as he said, the flour the bread was made of had been stolen. Some benevolently inclined men, and many religious zealots, thought that religion and education was the open sesame by means of which the salvation of the Negro was to come. So they sent him money to build churches and to found great schools. Many, however, are now finding that though the Negro may have religion, he has no morality, and that too often his education makes him unwilling to do what he can do and wish to do that for which he is unfitted or for which there is no demand. At present, who can tell whether he is going forward or backward? Someone has said that there is going on side by side in the Negro people a minimum of progress with a maximum of regress. However, the Negro takes great pride in his church, and in his way is intensely religious, the late Booker T. Washington said. Of these millions of black people, there is only a very small percentage that does not have formal or informal connection with some church. It is indeed likely that more than one half of the male Negro adults are actual members of church, while not more than one in four or five white male adults have such connection. Notwithstanding such a showing, religion does not seem to have any controlling influence over the life and character of the Negro. Nevertheless, the Negro enjoys his religion, for he is an emotional animal. It is the emotional element in religion that appeals to him and makes his face to shine. The promise of never-ending pleasure in a world to come may be but faintly comprehended by him, but the fear of a far-off punishment deters him but little from crime. He is the optimist of the human race and lives in the eternal present. He has no sorrows from the past and no care except for the immediate future. He keeps, without effort or intention, two injunctions of Scripture. Visit the sick and have no care for tomorrow. He goes to camp meetings or revivals, sings, prays and shouts until the small hours of the night. He may think he thus pays the Lord his due, even though the next day, if he works at all, he sleeps on the plough handle or with his half-closed eyes cuts up the tobacco or the cotton. However he may be free from the painful necessity to work the next day, if his wife or mother should have just returned from a white neighbour with an apronful, even if he did not visit some tempting smokehouse or hen roost on the way home from his religious revelry. How can Negro criminality and immorality be lessened? The answer is not easy, and what follows is merely suggestive. Up to the present, what little the Negro has accomplished, in most part, has been due to the white blood he has received, or to white direction and sympathy. The Negro is woefully lacking in initiative and persistence. He would be greatly benefited by some sort of probationary oversight. If the Filipinos are not fit for self-government collectively, much less the Negro individually, a great part of them are no more fit to profit by their freedom than so many children. Nothing so promotes health of body and strength of character as regular and persistent industry. To the Negro should be preached the gospel of salvation through work. Somehow get him to work 6 days in the week instead of working two and loafing four, as many do now. Industrial schools such as Hampton and Tuskegee meet a great need, but they touch but few. If the states had the power to train or even to enforce habits of industry and thrift upon the shiftless, idle and vicious Negroes, it would undoubtedly result in measureless benefit to both white and black. Liberty should not be made a fetish. If the Negro has rights, that should not be abridged. So have the white people rights and lives that should not be endangered. The law-abiding many have the right to protection from the criminal few, actual or incipient. With the adoption of some such scheme, the Negro might gradually cease to be a menace to the white race. Again, so often the Negro leaders of the Negro race are merely blind leaders of the blind, entirely lacking in breadth of view, often discouraging in their race what they should encourage, and encouraging what they should discourage, as the following quotation may indicate. Make lynching a federal crime, and stop turning the murderers over to local authorities who are in sympathy with them, demanded Dr. W.T. Vernon of Memphis, Tennessee, before 15,000 Negroes who were celebrating the 25th Quadrennial Conference of the African M.E. Church in Convention Hall, Broad Street and Allegheny Avenue yesterday. Such talk as this serves to promote Negro crime. If, instead of Negro leaders writing articles for magazines and Negro papers, in sermons, in Negro churches, and in addresses before Negro conventions, denouncing the whites for protecting themselves against Negro crime in their own way, could realize that it is not so much the black skin as what sort of man the black skin covers that counts, would demonstrate to their black brothers that they themselves are the sinners rather than the sinned against, that they are the transgressors rather than otherwise, they might accomplish much towards lessening Negro crime. If such leaders would use their influence to the utmost to make their race as law-abiding as the whites, and should bring it about, it is hardly likely that then they would need to complain that their race is imposed upon. But if they were, at least there would be more force in their complaint. But so long as the Negro race commits its present amount of crime, the complaint against unfair treatment is more than childish.
listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.